Chris, thank you very much indeed. Just before we throw this open, I think if Zoe's agreeable, I'll act as second roving mic for this side of the room. So if anyone this side has a question, I'll come to you. Something struck me very powerfully about that last example that you were talking about there, and that was something that happened on 9/11. Right. Just before the first plane went into the tower, and there's footage of people in the street, I think there was a news camera there. And one of the really striking things, I assume these were all urban Americans, they're all reasonably well-traveled, sophisticated people. They heard the sound of a plane, but they didn't look up. They look around them as if this is something coming from a car or from a shop doorway. And that's a perfect illustration, a rather poignant illustration of what you were talking about, that contextualizing.
Absolutely.
And the kinds of expectations that you have of sound.
Yeah, because the brain has, you're getting a huge amount of information coming into the brain, and we can't process it. The brain is very, very powerful, but it is limited in terms of its processing capacity. So we have to attend to certain things. So you tend to zone out on things that aren't particularly interesting. They're not novel. They're things that you would expect anyway. There's a really nice sort of, it's almost a sort of reverse example of this. There was a mining community, I can't remember if it was Wales or Nottingham or somewhere, it doesn't really matter, but they used to change the shift at, say, 6 o'clock in the morning, and there'd be a big sort of siren to signal the change of shift. And of course, everybody got used to this quite quickly, and they just sleep through it. And then the pit was closed down, and the siren didn't occur anymore, and everybody woke up at 6 o'clock. So again, when things are expected, they're in the environment. The brain isn't interested in things that it knows about. It wants to know about things it doesn't know about, right? So anything that falls into expectations is going to be generally ignored. So that's another good example.
One just final maybe physiological question that intrigued me. One of the musicians I've been obsessed with for years, Ornette Coleman, has always been a rather controversial figure. People will tell you that he simply doesn't understand harmony. He just never got it. He missed the lessons or misread them or whatever. Others who are maybe more supportive say that he hears differently. He hears sound in a different way. Are there physiological situations other than insult to the ear, insult to the brain, some pathology like rubella or whatever, whereby people actually hear differently to the norm in a quantifiable way?
That's a tough question. I mean, there are examples of people with trauma hearing very differently, and you get these sort of, people, some remarkable things can happen. I think Oliver Sacks talks about one where someone was struck by lightning and suddenly had this amazing musical ability just pop out of nowhere. And other people, they might have some sort of hearing impairment. It really affects their way of tuning. A lot of what how we appreciate and understand music depends on our experience of it. But there are certain sort of fundamentals, like the sort of an octave, for example, and certain musical intervals that seem to be universal to all cultures. But there are some types of ways intervals are used in music that correspond to particular cultures. And different types of intervals are going to be very common in Western music, say major third or something like that. And others are going to be more common in other cultures. So the experience definitely makes a big difference. But, it's a question. It might be something to do with the listening experience.
There's a huge misunderstanding about that, isn't there, when people say the octave doesn't apply in Balinese music or Japanese or Korean court music. It actually does. It's just divided a different way.
Yeah, and even the 12 intervals, even sort of you think about the quarter tones people talk about and things like that in Indian music, they're only used in passing. Generally, actually the 12-point scale is often comes or in many, many different cultures use that.
There's an American composer called Ezra Sims, who I think has never performed here, who has a 73-note octave. It's completely and utterly unlistenable stuff. I'm going to take the left wing, somebody on the right. If there are any questions or comments, there's one over there.
Chris, it was quite interesting to see the actual diagram of how our auditory system works, the external part of the auditory, our hearing ability. In extra loud music, we all get the sense that after prolonged exposure to very loud sound, the ear starts to close down. What's the actual mechanism for the ear desensitizing itself to loud sounds?
Okay, well there's a short-term mechanism, which is to do with the fact that neurons adapt. So if you stimulate a neuron, its peak firing is always near the beginning of a sound, and then it decays over time. So that has a small effect. But this sort of exposure you're talking about, which I have to say is probably a little bit dangerous. if you hear things going quieter. What you're doing there is you're basically, the outer hair cells, these things I talk about that do this amazing amplification, means that we can hear very quiet sounds and it also sharpens up our tuning. There's some very complex and sensitive metabolism goes on in there. And you basically wear it out and you generate these metabolic byproducts, these free radicals, that start to damage the cells. Now, you can get away with a certain amount of... if you go to a loud concert, you might go away and you might have a bit of ringing in the ears, a bit of tinnitus, because you're hearing the sensitivity has been reduced. Tinnitus is a very interesting thing. You know, why is it you hear sounds when you go deaf? And it's probably because the ear is sort of compensating for the loss of information. If you get neurons, a bunch of neurons, and they've done this in a Petri dish or whatever, and you don't give them any input, they kind of go a little bit mad. When you give them the input, they organize themselves and they start firing sensibly. So it could be something to do with that. Anyway, sorry, I digress. So the outer hair cells, they're very sensitive to damage, both by loud sounds, both by drugs. I talked about aspirin, that's temporary as well. And it takes some time to recover. And there was this crazy gentleman who used to present papers at Acoustical Society of America, I used to go to, and he used to stand up and say, right, you know, this time I've exposed myself to a level of 130 dB for half an hour, and here's how my hearing sort of got back to normal over several months. And he used to, the next, you know, he'd up the ante and the next time, and then he stopped coming. I don't know whether he finally went deaf, but so it can recover very slowly, and there's a slow recovery in it, but it's thought to be due to the fact that the outer hair cells are just getting tired and wearing out. But if you do that too much, you permanently damage them. And you can actually damage, if you have very impact noise, like gunshots, they can damage the stereocilia. And unfortunately, they don't grow back. And there are only about sort of 12,000 of these things, which isn't very many compared to the number of receptors in the retina. So you have to really look after them. And as you get older, you get a thing called presbycusis, gradually deterioration in high frequency hearing as you get older. But this is accelerated if you've been exposed to loud sounds.
Are there any frequency issues with loud sound and damage that it causes? Are there any frequencies which are more damaging than others?
You tend to get, if you look at the audiogram, if you look at the pattern of hearing loss for someone with noise induced loss, it tends to be in the region of sort of 2 to 4 kilohertz. And that's because the ear is very sensitive to that region, because that's the resonant frequency of the ear canal.
Thank you very much. In regards to like sound production and stuff, you know, the continuousness in that wave and stuff. I'm wondering, is that the same mechanism in place when applying sustained piano note to make it seem like, well, low-level white noise to make it seem like it lasts longer? Is that the same way you fill in the brain in regards to applying the white noise?
Right, so the idea there will be you produce this sort of jitter, this stimulation, mm-hmm. to keep on activating. Yeah, yeah. I actually, that's a good idea. I don't know, I haven't actually thought about that personally, but it seems to make sense. I mean, it's certainly the case, if you do like brain imaging experiments, to keep the brain going, you need to keep on hitting it with sound. You can't just go doo for half an hour and hope that it just gets bored. So yeah, that could well be the case. Actually, I do know one example of that. If you play a high frequency tone at a relatively low level, it gradually, as you're listening to it, it gradually fades out, and that's due to neural adaptation. But if you put a break in the tone, then turn it on again, then it comes back. So yeah, I guess that is sort of similar to what you're saying. So yeah.
Thanks.
Anyone else? Another one here.
Hi, I was interested in the place theory idea of note recognition or pitch recognition.
The place?
Yeah, on the basal membrane.
Right, recognition. Yeah.
Could you give us your views on whether or not the perfect pitchability is a learned process, an innate process, or is it physiological or psychological? And then if you could then maybe say why it took so long for side 2 of Kind of Blue to be produced at the correct pitch.
That's a bit too technical for me. Well, it's interesting you mentioned that sort of place theory. You know, the basilar membrane does separate out the frequency of sounds, but it seems that the pitch of sounds probably, and there is debate about this, is encoded by the temporal pattern of firing rather than necessarily which part of the basilar membrane is active. And the reason for that is that this ability of neurons to phase lock goes on up to about 4,000 to 5,000 hertz. And that is about the limit at which we can actually hear musical melodies. Beyond that, you can hear something changing, but it doesn't sound, you can't hear intervals. Okay. So we think that might be a sort of temporal thing. But place seems to play some, you can do it, there's a group of patients who have cochlear implants, you might have heard of these things. If you've got very profound hearing loss, you can stick electrodes up around the cochlea and stimulate the auditory nerve directly. And because you've got sort of, you can actually specify which area of the cochlea you can stimulate, you can, you know, people have done some quite nice experiments. And we know that you can generate a pitch percept just by varying, just by having one electrode and just by varying the rate of the pulses that are delivered to it. But there also seems to be some kind of trade-off. So we're better at processing pitch when it corresponds to the place in the basilar membrane that's normally active. Okay. So the place might come into that. Now, to do with absolute pitch, most people think that it's due to early experience at a very early age, say sort of in the first 2 or 3 years. And it's an interesting absolute pitch if people don't know about it. It's the ability to, we do this with colors, right? We see red and we say, that's red. But for most people, you play a particular note and they wouldn't know whether it was an A, B, C, whatever. Someone with absolute pitch would be able to say exactly what they have some sort of absolute reference for what the frequency of that note is. And it's probably due to, the general thinking now is that there might be some genetic effects that predispose you to have absolute pitch, but you need to have the experience. A very interesting thing is that there are some languages that use tones to change the meaning of words. Things like Mandarin Chinese, Cantonese, Thai, a lot of these languages. They have various sort of variations in frequency, not just to carry the intonation, but to actually differentiate. So you can say the same thing with a different pitch contour, and it means, or produce the same sound, different pitch contour, and it means different things. Individuals in those cultures have a higher incidence of absolute pitch, and it's thought that's because they're exposed to these tones from an earlier age. But it's something that hasn't really been explored in all that much detail yet. So I think it is probably experience, but there might be some genetics in there.
Any other questions? Well, there'll be ample time, and I'm sure the is there? Sorry.
Hi there. I was quite interested in the McGurk thing.
Yeah.
Has there been any incidences of where you could have, like, if you could develop that to have, like, a conversation, like, that could be played over the radio, and you could have, like, one meaning, and then if you put it to television, it could have a completely, totally different...
Yeah, that's a really nice idea. I'm surprised...
And using a propaganda tip.
Yeah, I get the idea. I'm just trying to think how... Because it... I mean, the Bardar one, I think you can do it with car, as... Car-tar as well. I think there are other sort of versions. So it's a question of how many syllables we'd have to play with. I mean, it would be a sort of brain teaser. It's like sort of writing a book without letter E, which someone has done, I think. Or writing a sort of writing a book with just with the E vowel or something. You have to sort of think about the different way of combining these sounds to make different meanings. But it should be possible. So maybe you could work on that as a project, and we'd bring it to next year's meeting or something. But that's a really nice idea. I haven't thought about that. I don't know whether anybody's ever tried that, not to my knowledge, anyway.
Just another thing. It's about using high frequencies to re-stimulate damaged ears. Is there much research into that? I'd read about that. It was maybe a few years ago. I read it. It was a guy called Addy Newton. I don't know if you've heard of him. Addy Newton. He's from the Anti Group. I just read there was some research into using high frequencies to re-stimulate damaged hair cells. I don't know if that was
right.
A truism or
what. I mean, the conventional hearing aids, they will amplify sounds, and you can amplify sounds in different regions, and they also compress sounds, because hearing impaired people, they can hear loud sounds, just as loud as often just as loud as normal hearing people. They just can't hear the quiet ones, so that you need to just amplify the low-level ones. And they do that on a frequency-specific basis. I think what you're suggesting is a bit more than that, isn't it? It's actually adding in additional components that aren't there in the original sound rather than just modifying the spectrum. I'm afraid I'm not aware of that. I mean, it would be possible to do that. I'm just trying to think. I mean, it really suggests that the input to the ear is impoverished in that case if the high frequencies aren't there when they should be there. So maybe, you know, if you're listening over the telephone where you get quite a narrow range of frequencies, you might be able to do things just like, you know, adding additional. I mean, there are lots of devices, you know, sort of processing tools that you use in the studio that can do things like that. I think they're called exciters, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Where you can add in different high harmonics. I don't know of any of that particular example you're talking about.
Okay, and just a last one. It's about when you say that the ears are when the hair cells get damaged and then it tries to compensate by adding in sharp sort of peak frequencies. Can you like try and determine what frequencies those are and then try and sort of attenuate them by feeding in sort of like phase reverse of phase?
Oh, I see. Yeah. Unfortunately, no. I mean, you can modulate. This is tinnitus we're talking about. So if you have damage to the ear, then you tend to get you often get these high frequency noises. They're often associated, in fact, with the edge of the damage. It's where the normal region goes into the undamaged region. Into the damaged region. Now, the tinnitus that you hear is generated in the nervous system, I just thought. Your idea, which is a very clever one, is to present a sound sort of in the opposite phase to the tinnitus at the same frequency and try and cancel it out. Unfortunately, auditory nerve fibers, they rectify everything. Okay, so you only get nerve impulses are only one directional, so it wouldn't work. You just increase the noise, unfortunately.
that leads me to so, from my understanding, is like when the nerve impulse is sent down, is it the axon? I think.
Yeah.
Where there's gaps in the axon where it needs to gather more energy as it sends the signal to the brain.
Yeah, the nodes of Romvier, so it sort of jumps between these places.
Can't you sort of like stop it sending the signal from that? Can't you sort of...
There's no way you can really modify what individual neurons are doing without severe... we can't do single cell recordings really on single cell stimulation on human listeners. I mean, cochlear implants, you stimulate loads, you know, thousands of neurons at the same, each electrode at the same time. We don't have that degree of specificity. And it would be difficult, I think, I suppose it might theoretically be possible if you had a sophisticated enough system to target all those neurons that are producing the bad sound and just inhibit them. So that is potential, but it's way, way, way beyond current technology. Okay.
Thanks.
I think we better move on, folks. Yep.
Now, this event is called See Here, and the tagline, as I was saying earlier, for Kill Your Timid Notions, exploring the borders between sound and vision. And I guess now we have an example of two sub-disciplines eyeing each other across the borderline, like guards in watchtowers or listening towers. It's a great pleasure to welcome to See Here Dr. Ben Tatler of University of Dundee, who's going to be talking in a similar way about visual perception. And Ben, I can throw a quick question to you as well before you you start formally. Or have you some preparation to do?
No, I just have to put some plugs in, so it should be fine.
I guess we hear before we see, and the last thing we do in life is hear. Is there a sense in which visual perception becomes culturally privileged over the early years of our life? Is that something that is instilled into us, do you think?
I wasn't really paying attention then.